Hi, I'm Andrew, and I'm making my grandfather Vertuca's spaghetti and meatballs in Parkridge, Illinois. And you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you very much, and welcome to Outside the Loop. Yeah, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. This is show number 776. And of course, what we do here on this show is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention all over the interwebs, the intertrons on Twitter. At Outside the Loop is the handle. Facebook, Instagram, all that good stuff. Website, OutsideTheLoopRadio.com. And get the audio archives of the show there, all 15 years worth. You could also go to WGNRadio.com and, of course, subscribe to the podcast of this show for free. If you already do, you're the greatest. Bob Ferguson, he's pretty great, too. He's the engineer this morning in the WGN Radio studios. And Colin Seaman, he is great also as the producer of the show. Hi, Colin.
Hi, Mike.
So, something I've noticed driving on area highways here is like the amazing, and I say amazing because it's just mind-blowing how folks do this, the graffiti that shows up on like the sides of the expressways in Chicago. First of all, it's increasing. It actually, according to this news report I'm reading here, graffiti reports are up 30% in Chicago, and crews are struggling to keep up with removing it. I mean, I was looking recently on the Eisenhower, and there were like, it's like a two-story sort of concrete wall, and there are giant graffiti, I don't know, instances that are like the entirety of that two stories. I don't know how people do it in like in the middle of the night and not fall into the L tracks, you know?
Yeah, I don't know if this defeats the purpose, but there is a lot of walls that are sort of open and available. Why can't we sort of designate some zones? I know that probably like cuts against where artists want to put their stuff, but like I feel like we've got a lot of walls that could use some art, could use expression, because I imagine that's what people are doing these days, just finding ways to express themselves because it's a mad world. So can we just designate like certain zones of the city to be like art zones? Can't we just do that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good idea. I like that idea. Of course, you know, when we talk about graffiti, there's like some really great art that's out there. But some instances, what I'm reading here, according to these reports of some, you know, offensive or racist, inflammatory tagging of sorts, that's not good. But if we could have like art installations like designated, and I know some areas do have like mural walls, which is really cool. Maybe we just need more of that. We could do that along the expressway, right?
Yeah, I mean, why not? You generally want drivers' eyes on the road, but yeah, I'm with your thinking there.
That's true. I didn't think about the fact that people are driving at a pretty high speed. Maybe not the greatest spot to look at artwork.
Well, I mean, if it's like a regular Tuesday morning, then you're only going about 7 miles an hour anyway.
That's right, because the traffic is pretty bad around these parts, especially during rush hour. Well, Colin, we have a pretty good show for the listener today. Well, first, I got to say, we'll check in with Steve Krakow, the great Steve Krakow, the author of The Secret History of Chicago Music Strip. We will learn about a 1980s new wave band called The Odd, and they're really good. And then we'll talk about some environmental issues on the statewide level, and then we'll head on up to Edgewater, that neighborhood, and talk about some environmental issues going on in Edgewater. Colin, I'm excited for the show today. I like what we've got on tap, and it'll be glorious.
Completely agree.
You're the greatest. This is Outside the Loop. Mike Steven here along with you. Don't be graffitiing unless it's a designated graffiti area or a easel in your basement. Outside the Loop, we like to keep tabs on how our city and state is handling environmental issues. The Illinois Environmental Council is an organization that advocates for environmentally friendly policy in our state. You can check out that organization at ilenviro.org. Colleen Smith is the deputy director of the Illinois Environmental Council, and she is here with us on Outside the Loop today. Colleen, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mike. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, nice to talk to you again. And boy, I feel like, you know, at the beginning of the summer, I was a little optimistic, like, you know, maybe we'll pass some legislation, we'll get some things done. I feel like it's been a kind of a, I don't know if it's a roller coaster, if that's the right analogy to use, but can you just give us a sense, generally speaking, where are we right now in the environmental saga here in Illinois when it comes to policy? Are we in a good place, a not so good place? Are we kind of in the middle? Where are we?
Well, that's a great question. And whether we're calling it a roller coaster or a saga, it has certainly been several years that we couldn't afford to wait on. But that being said, I'm optimistic still that when the legislature returns next Tuesday, there will be a comprehensive clean energy bill that they will be able to vote on. You know, when May 31st, the clock struck midnight, we didn't have a clean energy bill yet, in large part because there was a pushback for closing Illinois' dirtiest polluting coal plant, the Prairie State Energy Campus. Mm-hmm. And since then, we've continued to negotiate all summer over the fact that a true climate change bill needs to close Prairie State, which accounts for almost a third of Illinois' carbon emissions, and that it needs to guarantee that Black and brown communities who are already disproportionately impacted will not be shut out of the clean energy economy. So we've been having these conversations about these ongoing issues. Negotiations are still happening as we speak. And well, it may seem like Tuesday is right around the corner. If there's one thing that's true about Springfield is big bills can definitely get pulled together. And we've been talking about this for a long time. The cost of doing nothing is colossal, and I'm really optimistic that we'll still get this done next week.
Yeah, you know, what you said right there, the cost of doing nothing is colossal. And that was, I think, reinforced earlier this month. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change issued a report, and it's grim. I mean, it really spells out human effects on planet Earth, and when we talk about the environment, and really gives us some warnings. And so in the wake of that report, where are we in terms of, like, is this a make or break moment for us here in Illinois? Because I feel like we're kind of on the edge, but we really need to do something pretty quickly here.
Absolutely. That report called it out. We're at code red for humanity. They called it a death knell for coal and fossil fuels before they destroy our planet. You know, we have already been seeing the impacts of climate change day in and day out throughout Illinois, whether it's, you know, historic droughts, historic flooding. I'm calling from Chicago, where it's hotter than most days outside right now. And then, you know, we'll have polar vortexes. So climate change is all around us. It's impacting public health. It's impacting our economy. We have to act for those reasons. But we also know that August 31st is a very real deadline for the solar industry that had been seeing tremendous growth in Illinois following previous energy legislation. And if we're not able to pass a bill next week, we'll see job losses from that sector that had been growing at such a significant rate. So we have to act for that point of urgency. And we also have to act for both the jobs at nuclear plants that are slated to close and for the communities who are already facing coal plant closures, where what's happening to those communities and the property tax dollars and those workers, we need to be investing back into those communities in a just transition. So we have all of these different points of urgency, and I think that is not lost on anyone in the General Assembly or certainly anyone in our community. And that's really what's driving everyone working so hard over the next few days to still get this done.
You mentioned nuclear power. What is the future of nuclear power in Illinois? I know you talked about power plants closing, and certainly with the Prairie State Power Plant, I mean, that was a huge emitter of pollution, not a nuclear plant, but we should say. But when we talk about these power plants closing, and specifically with nuclear energy, what's the future of nuclear here?
Certainly. I mean, right now, we've seen that nuclear is a significant portion of our power generation in Illinois. And while we don't believe nuclear energy is clean energy, the issues of waste are still impacting communities like Zion on Lake Michigan in the north suburbs. But at the same time, the cost of inaction and letting those plants close would be significant for those communities and for 2,000 union jobs. I'm grateful that in this conversation, we were able to see the governor stood strong, as well as the General Assembly. And despite Exelon demanding, you know, a $5 billion rate hike and bailout, that they are not going to get that subsidy that they've asked for, and instead are getting the bare minimum of what they need to stay open so that we can continue to move towards a fully renewable clean energy economy by 2050.
And I know that you said the next few days are going to be crucial. And at the beginning of our conversation, we were talking about some legislation, but let's specifically call that out. The Clean Energy Jobs Act, which I've talked about on this program a bunch, I feel like, but we're starting to see movement that that could actually be a reality, something that the state legislature has been working on, it seems, forever.
Certainly. You know, we introduced the Clean Energy Jobs Act in 2019 after having 100 plus community conversations throughout the state asking people what their vision of a clean energy future looked like and really drafting policy because of that, which is, if you know anything about Illinois and Springfield, certainly not how energy policy has been made.
Right.
It's often very utility focused and their interest. And we've seen a process for the first time where those actors haven't had the loudest voice in the room. And that is tremendous. We wouldn't have been able to do that without the last several years of building the support. And I think because communities are really seeing these points of urgencies and the need to take action on climate change, we're still debating certain pieces of the bill and whether or not, you know, that's what it's called at the end of the day. What's most important is it's a meaningful climate bill. We've said that. We reaffirmed that earlier this week as the Clean Jobs Coalition. Governor Pritzker has reaffirmed his commitment to only signing a true climate bill multiple times over this summer. And so if we're not able to say that it takes the steps needed, if we're not able to say it delivers benefits to Black and brown communities most impacted by climate change, you know, then it won't be a bill that we can support. So those are the remaining details that we hope to be worked out. But again, I think this is going to get done on Tuesday and be a historic win for all of Illinois.
Let's be optimistic. I like that attitude, Colleen, and we'll keep an eye on what's going to happen here across our state when it comes to environmentally friendly policy. And that's really important, as we talked about today. Colleen Smith is the Deputy Director of the Illinois Environmental Council, online at ilenviro.org. Colleen, always a pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Enjoy your day.
Let's talk about the environment on a neighborhood level. The Edgewater neighborhood is working towards a greener community. The Edgewater Environmental Coalition is a group of community members trying to empower residents to build and maintain a more sustainable neighborhood and future. They're online at sustainededgewater.org, and Trisha Van Eck is the co-chair of the Edgewater Environmental Coalition. She is with us here on Outside the Loop today. Trisha, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You're quite welcome. So earlier in the show, we were talking about the state of Illinois and environmental policy on a state level. But getting down to the neighborhood level here, overall, how is Edgewater doing when it comes to environmental issues and trying to green up the neighborhood?
We're trying to do our part to make Edgewater one of the greenest neighborhoods in the city, and we're doing that through a number of initiatives. One is local composting with restaurants, offering a collective resource has offered to supply restaurants with free composting thanks to a grant from the Edgewater Chamber and the SSA. And we're working on a number of initiatives with the community, planting native plants at the Osterman Beach, working with Vegwater Garden to offer different classes on how to make how to be more sustainable with native planting. We're trying to educate the public in as many ways possible as what to do with waste, what to do with planting, and other green initiatives like transportation, water, housing. We're working on very granular levels, what to do in your own backyard, to actually thinking about city policy. Our alderman is the head of the housing department for the city council, and we're looking at what kind of legislation that Alderman Osterman can work to make sure that housing and development, which represents 40% of all our greenhouse gases, what new developments and old developments, existing homes can do to create a greener environment so that houses are the places where we live are not causing more climate change. So what can we do on individual level, and then extrapolate from that? Is if every individual is doing their part, we could make a massive change rather than thinking about just what I can do myself, thinking about that, but also if it's compounded, what everyone can do. And then if the city and the neighborhood as a collective are doing their part, then we, you know, the mound of information builds, and we have less waste, greener neighborhood, less pollution. We're also trying to connect with the south side, and then trying to connect north side and south side, because the south side has often been overlooked. And so how can our voice also incorporate other people's voices as well, so that we're not just one group, one neighborhood, but we're actually a host of neighborhoods. So dots around the city become a collective circle.
And, you know, you're talking about here educating the community, but also to an extent you're organizing. And I think that anytime this kind of community organizing happens, I mean, it's great, it's powerful, but it's also kind of tricky sometimes, and it can be difficult. So for you to get people on board with, you know, what you're doing here, and it's not so much you have to convince them, and maybe it's more of like you have to tell them, they have to know about it. And then there has to be a place where they can do that, or they can learn. How do you go about doing that? Because even in a community like Edgewater, I mean, there's tons of engaged folks, but you're always going to have some people that, you know, don't know what's happening, and they need to find out. How do you go about organizing?
Well, we're a volunteer organization that is all volunteers that have been around for 10 years. And some of those people have gone on to, you know, to actually affect policy. But also, we try to meet people where they're at. So different people are interested in different things. So there's a group that work on trees, that are really interested in trees. So they bond together with other people who are interested in trees. And when there's an issue like the recent sewer system that interfered with trees, they mobilized. There's another group that's interested in composting. And so they organized a pumpkin smash, which won an award. It was a really great event to bring kids and adults out to throw pumpkins in a box so that it could be composted. And then there's people who are interested in native planting. So then they work on native planting. There's people who are interested in composting their buildings. And so they're the ones who are actually trying to work with their neighbors to get to incentivize them to become interested in what they're interested in. So we can't say that we do it all. It's almost, again, that individual who's interested in that particular issue, they then take it on and try to mobilize and incentivize and activate the people in their circle who then want to, you know, be a part of it. So one little composting bin in a, you know, a building that has 1,000 units can actually become a building that has a robust composting program with like 400 compost bins. I mean, we're not there yet, but that is the idea, that one little individual can start affecting change within their circle of their house or their neighborhood or their block, and on and on and on.
Yeah. You know, when you talk to members of the Edgewater neighborhood about the environment, is there something, or are there just like a few things that they really seem to be excited about or concerned about or very much at the top of their minds? What are some of the things that these residents in Edgewater are thinking about when it comes to the environment?
So believe it or not, people get excited about waste and compost. So the Blue Bins program has been a disaster in the city, and mm-hmm. and every person understands the Blue Bins and understands, wow, this is not working. I've tried to do my part. What the hell is going on? And what can I do to change this? And can I mobilize the city? The city is actually trying to reinvent its waste program. It's been working with the Delta Institute. And but people think they understand their own waste, and they understand that they could maybe do something with their composting. So people really get excited about composting. It's kind of doesn't seem like it would be an exciting thing, but it's...
It can be, and that's wonderful, and an example of, you know, how people are engaged, in this case, in Edgewater. And the organization, Edgewater Environmental Coalition, doing some wonderful work up in Edgewater. Everyone should check out sustainededgewater.org. Tricia Van Eck is the co-chair of the Edgewater Environmental Organization. Tricia, best of luck with your continuing efforts. They're really important, and thanks for talking to us today.
Thanks so much for being interested in the environment and passing, and you're a part of it by, you know, spreading the word. So thank you very much.
Occasionally in the Chicago Reader, you will see the column, The Secret History of Chicago Music. It is hand-drawn by local musician, music historian, and artist Plastic Crime Wave. He's also known as Steve Krakow. This strip profiles a local musician or a band who never quite made it to the big time. So right now, let's dim those lights. Let's fire up the old hi-fi as we travel to Chicago's Ukrainian Village neighborhood and enter
The Secret History of Chicago Music. Got a little dance now. I want to teach you.
Name of the dance now. We got a lane to. Yes, dialing up across town, connecting to the layer of an apartment, and one Mr. Steve Krakow, the author of The Secret History of Chicago Music strip in the Chicago Reader, and online at chicagoreader.com. And Steve, this week we are getting new wavy with a band called The Odd. I like it.
The Odd, yeah. I mean, and a band that didn't even release an album, so we're digging pretty deep into kind of obscurity, but they were a popular band, so there you go. You got all kinds of dichotomies right there.
All kinds of twists and turns in this story.
The Odd.
The Odd. So I thought this was kind of interesting. You start off this particular piece that you wrote, and you say, like, you know, hey, people are always wondering, you know, I've been doing this strip for more than 15 years. How do you find these bands? And sometimes they find you. That's kind of what happened this time, right?
Yeah, I said I had to admit, you know, the that's kind of one of my favorites, because it's sort of takes a load off for me, you know, just yeah. The workload department. But and it's always interesting. And, you know, I have to admit, I've gotten some that are like, oh, sorry, your band's only like 5 years old. You're not quite hit. history yet, you know, but more often than not, you know, people have hit me up and, you know, they got a full archive of the music, and that really helped here because, like I said, they're sort of an under documented band. But yes, Mr. Hugh Hart, who's led quite a life and career, hit me up and was like, hey, maybe you'd want to write up my band. And I was like, yeah, this is really cool. Let's do it. You know, and he was very organized. So, yeah.
So Hugh Hart hit you up, as you said. He is from Chicago. He was raised in Rogers Park. And, you know, it's interesting because the members of this band, The Odd, I mean, they all have interesting stories and very much involved with music, even, you know, later on in life. So they've kind of done a lot of different things.
Well, he had kind of like an early band, which I thought was interesting, that were sort of almost like a, I guess, kind of like a novelty band. And he called it Huge Heart.
Nice.
So, you know, Hugh Hart is a character right off the bat. But yeah, it was. He had a lot of members in this band, period. There was like a four person lineup, a 5-person lineup, and a 6-person lineup. And it changed quite a bit, but definitely some characters sort of went, through there. Joe Jackson, who later became Joe Dare. She's an interesting one for sure. She had like super powerhouse voice. I believe she was in the 5-person lineup that I drew for the strip, and she ended up doing like a duet with Freddie Mercury later on.
Wow.
Which is very findable on YouTube. I was like, whoa. And yeah, she had like a whole career later on herself, basically. And, you know, and was sort of like as he stated, you know, I sort of asked everyone sort of unique influences. She was, you know, kind of the Pat Benatar school a little bit, you know.
This group, Hugh Hart, and then, you know, Huge Hart, this band, you say that they were playing up and down Lincoln Avenue, places like Wise Fool's Pub, and they were playing New Wave, and eventually this band morphs into The Odd, and they're playing New Wave. And tell us, I mean, I feel like with New Wave, you kind of know it when you hear it, but how would you classify New Wave?
I guess, you know, I mean, in a way, it is sort of overused, you know, like any genre, you know, punk rock, you know, it could be anything from the crustiest gutter punk to like some guy who's got $1 million and spikes in his hair and does pop punk for the kids, you know, you know, there's such a range, and new wave, you know, could be anything from like, you know, the really synthesizer driven sort of asymmetrical haircut kind of stuff that maybe people think of, to more what they called, you know, at the beginning of it, you know, sort of quirky rock and roll, you know. And at one time, I think punk and new wave were almost just synonymous, you know. But I guess, you know, a big inspiration for Hugh was Elvis Costello. And I would say he's sort of typified, you know, that's a sort of a jittery, sort of edgy quality to it, but also sort of like a simple rock and roll thing, but then also sort of like modern, you know, for 1979, 1980, you know, or right, whenever that stuff was first recorded, it had a modern sound that people hadn't heard before at the same time, you know. So, I mean, some new wave bands were even kind of like surfy and stuff, you know. There's you know, like the Go-Go's or something, you know, or just like almost like poppy and kind of like Beach Boys music or something like that. So, yeah, I think it was a real range, you know.
Yeah. And this band, The Odd, I mean, they had some good gigs. They were playing great places like Tuts. I mean, years ago, this is, you know, 1980. In the 1980s, they're playing Tuts. They're, you know, they're playing all over in Rogers Park. They're at the Thirsty Whale in River Grove. Absolutely. They're down right in Champaign. And then they're opening up for some fairly big names at the time. They have some really good, really good opening gigs.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny. I think the names in a way sort of typify the range of new wave in a way, because you look at Greg Kinn. There would be the three mainstream sort of new wave, at least towards the end of his of his career. I you know, aka the breakup song, or, and some of his bigger things. The Romantics, you know, who were also like a big hit making, very chart friendly, you know, kind of band. You know, we come on, we know the hits. What I Like About You,
right?
The Talking in Your Sleep song, you know, very mainstream. But then also Split Enz, who turned into Crowded House and were a very weird band. Very. Look up a picture of early Split Enz.
Yeah, I've seen them. I've seen. They're strange.
Yeah, it's like Roxy Music on crack or something. You know, they it's like Oompa Loompas meet Roxy Music or something. They were like the very weird end of new wave, which people don't really realize, because they ended up having hits kind of later on as well. But and the Talking Heads, another band who went through pretty much all the changes of like a very quirky, almost punky kind of band to a very smooth band using synthesizers and like African rhythms produced by big producers, you know, by the end of the, you know, the 80s.
I mean, awesome. You're opening up for the Talking Heads. That is craziness.
Yeah, 1980. And that, you know, that seems like that's kind of before the, you know, we won't call it the sellout era, but kind of before the big radio era for them. They were still kind of like an edgy, weirder band. But even, you know, he noted in the interview, even by 1980, within like 2 or 3 years of their existence, they had kind of turned into another band, because he had seen them play earlier and they were more in their psycho killer kind of phase. And he was like, this was like a pretty different band by the time we were kind of prepared for more of this kind of edgy punky thing a little bit, you know.
So the Odd, they don't last too long. They break up in March of 1983 with a farewell gig at Tuts. What ends up happening to this band? What happened here?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because they, like, you know, they went through so many lineup changes. They did indeed get a track on a Loop Records compilation. You know how the Loop used to put out those compilation LPs? And
yeah, 97.9, man, yeah.
Yeah, man, and very, you know, very celebrated locally, playing these great gigs and stuff. And then, yeah, they really were only around. I mean, some of the great bands, if you think about it, they were only around for like 3 to 5 years, you know, that are now so deified. You know, they all sort of went on, like Hugh had a bunch of bands later on. Hugh Hart and the Magnificent Seven, Planet Hugh, another way, and another band that didn't have his name in it, Wedge. Uh-huh. And funny enough, he was a freelance reader writer, like yours truly. And I guess these days he mostly reviews movies and TV for New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Wired, all these sort of impressive publications.
Very
and he's
cool.
He's got a new 4-song EP as well, Mr. Hart, called Dog Park, which came out this year.
Look at that. Well, it's quite the story of the new wave band The Odd from here in Chicago from the 1980s. We're looking at 1980 to 1983, and you can get the complete story at chicagoreader.com, The Secret History of Chicago Music. It is written by Steve Krakow, also known as Plastic Crime Wave. He also hand draws a picture of the whoever he is profiling. And Steve, it's always a pleasure talking to you, and you stay new and wavy.
And you stay odd. 2 weeks later, she was out that yard. That's when I fell for Elizabeth. She makes me
That's the Rap Party for Outside the Loop show number 776, where Colin and I do a little recap of the show, offer some takeaways, and I was inspired by what I was hearing coming out of Edgewater, community folks getting together and pitching in and inspiring others to get excited about the environment as well. And I think that was a pretty cool, you know, angle, I think, when we talk about environment, which, you know, we do on more than one occasion here, but it's an important issue. So I thought that was pretty refreshing and a good reminder that this kind of caring on the community level is happening.
Yeah, it's really encouraging. It feels like, you know, you referenced the IPCC report, which is way outside the loop. It's like not even Chicago. Like, Mike, this is a show about Chicagoland. Why are you referencing a global report? Well, listener, just to let you know, that global report is the first time ever the science has been so exact as to projecting how regions across our globe are going to potentially look if we sort of stay on this path that we're on with regards to carbon and climate change. And the Midwest, our region, things are changing and they're baked in for the next 20 to 30 years. That's like wetter and hotter. So Lou's coming up next. You want to call him? If you got water problems, you're going to have more of those water problems. And
it's true.
Systems need to change, and those systems can be your system, you as a person, your neighborhood system, and the state system, the federal system, the global system. Like, it just all has to work for us to do this. And that is a lot, and that makes you want to like roll your eyes in the back of your head because you can't even process all that. But that's where we are. So if we are going to, and this is the heartbreaking part of it, if we are going to somehow get a chance to stabilize things after the next 30 years of crud that's coming our ways, that's, again, baked in, we have to do all this stuff now. We have to move fast. I mean, Mike, it breaks my heart that our kids won't see, like, won't even have the chance to see a stable climate until they're our age. And that's like if we move at lightning speed today. Breaks my heart.
Yeah. I think that's the takeaway here is we have to do this. I mean, we had to do this yesterday. So the imperative here is to get on this train of trying to fix things. And again, we have, like you said, even if we fixed everything today, the effects of this are still going to impact us for a few decades. And so we need to start caring. And I think it's, again, like inspirational. We talked about policy with Colleen Smith, and that's kind of exciting that we're, you know, finally on the right track here. I mean, she was very optimistic here in Illinois. But again, I keep coming back to Edgewater. I mean, it's community-based. You know, get excited about your waste. Get excited about composting. It's pretty easy to do all this stuff. And it's very necessary to do. So that was, I think that's kind of the big takeaway from, at least where I sit here, Colin, what I was thinking about. And I was inspired. I was inspired by what I heard today. Actually, there are lots of environmental groups in other neighborhoods, too. I mean, they're out there.
Yeah, but we need more of them, man.
Are you going to join one?
I'm going to start one. There's none in Portage Park. So let's start one.
Okay, you should start one, man. Get the alderman. You love the alderman. Get him over there.
I don't know if that's the word I'd use. We see eye to eye on trash. That's about it.
That's the wrap party for Outside the Loop show number 776. Wrap party. And that just about does it. Outside the Loop show number 776 is all wrapped up just for you. Thank you so much for listening to the show this week. Thanks to Colin for producing. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for being our engineer. Have a great week. I'll talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop on 720 WGN.